That's the music you hear under commercials for iPods. Do you have one? Good morning, I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's 10 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Monday, June the 16th. What is it that prompted you to buy an iPod rather than some other MP3 player? And what does it say about you? We'll talk this hour with a guest who knows why so many of us wanted iPods, and for that matter, why we wanted Hello Kitty merchandise, or why Pabst Blue Ribbon experienced an unexpected sales boost. We'll talk with the author of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. And we'll welcome your questions for him at 1-800-642-1234, in Madison 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Rob Walker is the author of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. He also writes a weekly column for New York Times Magazine, and he joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks a lot for being here. So, what made you buy an iPod?
Well, of course, I'm a very rational consumer, so I sorted through all the... No. I think that, you know, my quest to figure out the iPod is one of a number of examples in the book of things. I was looking for examples of products and brands that had really taken off in the new century that we're in with all of this technology, and we're always hearing how much smarter we are and more savvy than all the consumers of the past. And, you know, originally in the case of the iPod, I sort of set out, I was looking for what was the key in the device.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what was the one property of this thing that had made it so popular? And over time, I sort of finally figured out that it's not just about the device. It's about us. It's about the consumer and what we kind of bring to it, and which means there can be more than one answer for something like the iPod.
Right.
But more deeply than that, I think that that's where the sort of subtitle of the book comes from, that it's a dialogue between us and what we buy, and not a one-way process, as we sometimes kind of think it is.
Right. So it wasn't, I need to have this iPod because everybody else has an iPod.
Well, I think with some people, you know, you look around and you see those white headphones more and more often, and they become more and more familiar to you, and you just kind of assume that, like, well, this must be the best MP3 player around, and kind of seems like everybody else has one, so maybe I'll just do it. And, you know, what research, I can certainly say in my case, I did zero research in terms of, you know, what are the other alternatives and is this really the best thing for my particular individual needs. I just sort of relied on the shortcut of this is familiar, other people seem to have vetted it,
yeah.
So I'll just go for it.
Yeah, so there is a certain joining the club aspect to all this.
The interesting thing about the iPod is that I think that it kind of works both ways. It's both this individualistic thing because mm-hmm. you load it with your own music, and you know, people talk a lot about the idea that we're all very individualism obsessed now and mm-hmm. very customization obsessed, and we want to do our own thing. But on the other hand, there is the sort of comfort of the larger group, and you know, just being part of it. In the early days, I used to live in New York, and when this product was first taking off, they used to talk about the iPod nod of mm-hmm. people who, you know, had the white headphones, would sort of like acknowledge each other. This is before they became so ubiquitous that there was, you know, you'd be nodding all day. But that's the key, is that that's why it's not coming from the device, it's coming from us, because this one object can sort of satisfy these two completely contradictory sounding needs.
Yeah, and the individualistic aspect of the iPod or an MP3 player is that we can become our own radio station.
Absolutely, and or you know, you can sort of become all day long, you're listening to this sort of confirmation of your own excellent musical taste.
Yeah. So what does the iPod then have in common with, say, Pabst Blue Ribbon beer?
Yeah, well, the secret part of that secret dialogue in the subtitle is that I think that we sort of resist thinking about things like this. Consumer behavior and consumer culture sounds like something that other people are participating in, but we're kind of above it all. And, you know, I write that consume column. People are constantly coming up to me and saying, well, I'm not much of a consumer myself, mm-hmm. but I was reading your column and, you know, fill in the blank. And my view is that, in fact, we do all kind of take this stuff seriously, and PBR was an interesting example of a brand that, whose potency, for lack of a better word, was revitalized almost completely by consumers first. The company had no idea what was going on, and then the company kind of looked into it to figure out, why is this stuff selling again? It had been in decline for around 30 years when sales a couple years ago started to abruptly uptick in, not in Wisconsin, but in Portland, of all places, is where the resurgence started.
Yeah, and that it was not like Pabst had some marketing campaign to try to increase sales. Yeah. It just happened. And it happened because?
It happened because I went out there to talk to people about it, to talk to consumers about it, and it was younger people, college students, and a lot of bike messengers. And it had started because it was a local beer that had been kind of the default cheap beer for that crowd, and they had gone out of business. So there was sort of a need for a new default cheap beer. That's sort of where it started. And as it happened, PBR had this kind of, you know, lingering, like it was familiar. It was kind of, I think, maybe even almost ironic to some people. There were rumors that it was dying. And interestingly, something that came up in multiple conversations I had with people out there was that they liked the fact that PBR did not advertise. So it sort of became embraced as a kind of brand that embodied a distaste for marketing. Mm-hmm. Sounds very strange. But that was what people were telling me, and the PBR folks had had the same experience, is why they took this unusual approach when they saw this stuff happening. And initially, their instinct was, great, let's run some ads on the local radio stations and stuff like that. And they realized that that would actually work against them. So they ended up going directly to these groups of people, like in the book I talk about bike messengers who were playing this crazy bike polo matches in the park and smashing into each other. And they would sort of do mini sponsorships of events like that. And it's like, oh, we'll give you a few $100 and a few cases of PBR, and maybe you'll feel good about us. And that actually turned out to be pretty effective, because those bike messengers would mention it to their friends in other cities, who would in turn contact PBR.
Mm-hmm.
Before you knew it,
it was doing well.
The word was spreading. Yeah.
So people were buying PBRs in part because it was cheap, but also because it said, I'm campy, I'm cool, I'm for the underdog, I don't like advertising.
Yeah, and this I don't like advertising part was the most fascinating to me, because, you know, beer marketing is ubiquitous, it's obnoxious, people get sick of it. And so there was something that seemed more authentic about this beer that wasn't really playing that game. But as you probably know, PBR's actual connection to, say, Milwaukee was sort of long since severed. It had closed down its brewery there, and the brand was owned by a company in San Antonio, which owns a whole bunch of these sort of dwindling brands. And it was actually a terrible example of authenticity. You know, the brewing was sort of outsourced, and it was exactly, in a lot of ways, a precise example of the kinds of, you know, virtual companies that are all brand and no production that people like that tend to be against.
Yeah. So PBR sales in Portland still strong? Or
Yeah. And year over year, since then, they've continued to go up across the country every year. In Portland, I was just there again recently, and it is sort of amazing. There was a time 5 years ago when I believe they told me there were about 40 bars in all of Portland that had a PBR tap, and now it's hundreds and hundreds, and you see it everywhere.
Yeah, you talk a little bit more about, you referred to it when you talked about some of the marketing that went on for PBR, and that it's a term you say is marketing.
Yeah, well, there's this conventional wisdom idea out there that started when basically TiVo came on the scene, which was that this was going to be a great, empowering time for consumers and a bad time for advertisers, because now we were going to be able to zap through commercials. And you add that to things like the web and cell phones and all the various things that led to Time Magazine declaring that you are the person of the year. Remember that in 2006? Because we have all the power now. Well, advertisers, marketers are not dumb. They're very smart, and they're very they have a lot on the line, and they have a lot of money to spend. So they started figuring out new ways, new avenues to get their messages out. And along the way, the lines between, you know, what's marketing and what's everyday life leapt out of the confines of a magazine ad or a 30-second commercial. Those borders got a lot more murky, basically. So marketing is my blanket term for all the stuff that's been happening since, which can include anything from corporate-sponsored graffiti. There's a campaign in Toronto I was just reading about where Vespa has hired a noted graffiti artist to do work on the streets for them. You can't really TiVo past that.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other end of the spectrum is this completely voluntary, apparently, consumer embrace of things like PBR, like sort of coming up with their own meaning and significance for a brand without even a prompt from the company.
Yeah. And but when the company is doing some of the prompting, we are buying in.
Yeah.
So
the point of price.
Yeah, which is, so we've changed. How have we changed from, our folks and how they might have been purchasing products or making product buying decisions?
Well, over time, you know, branding in a broadest sense is basically this process of attaching an idea to a thing. And in the past, that idea might have been a very straightforward one, like this brand of flour is trustworthy and high quality. And you've seen how much more aggressive the ideas or ambitious the ideas attached to brands can be. Apple is a good one that's sort of making a case that, it's an individuality enabler and you're more of an individual when you consume Apple. Or Nike's relationship to athletic achievement, or mm-hmm. the Dove products, this amazing campaign where they're kind of making a statement about the nature of beauty, which is not something that I think you would have seen a company try 20 years ago. And what's more remarkable is that we are just willing to go along with it, and people will have serious conversations about the meaning of the Dove campaign, and you know, it's discussed on television and in magazines is perfectly legitimate now for marketing to start these kind of cultural conversations.
We're talking with Rob Walker. He is the consumed columnist for the New York Times Magazine. He is also the author of the new book, Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. What about you? Do you confess you're a part of this trend? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Glad to have you with us. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up this afternoon, it's At Issue with Ben Marins. After 5, Ben and his guest will discuss the new populist movement and how it's reshaping political discourse. That's coming up after 5 o'clock. We're talking with the author of the new book, Buying In, talking about our relationship with the stuff we buy, not just as consumers, but as a part of how we define ourselves. Wondering why you make the choices you make when you're at the department store or the grocery store. What is it that makes you loyal to a particular product? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Do you buy products because you think they're outside the mainstream? Are there brands out there that you've seen using this kind of marketing method that our guest is talking about to get the word out rather than relying on traditional advertising? We welcome your thoughts and questions as we talk about the things we buy and what that says about ourselves. And I had mentioned earlier in the hour, Rob Walker, that another example of this is the Red Hat Society. Mm-hmm. And those are the women who are, 50 plus, who buy yep. red hats and wear purple outfits and go nuts every once in a while.
Absolutely. And this It's a really interesting case because it started in a very informal way, and it certainly had nothing to do with brands. It wasn't a company coming along and saying, we want to sell red hats, and mm-hmm. so let's, you know, make up this this organization. It was socializing. It was the women felt good about it, and it was, you know, making a statement about their role in society. And very upbeat, very uplifting, and very nice people, I might add.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, they were wearing red hats and the purple dresses. And then from inside the group, there was sort of a feeling of, we need to make this kind of more official in some way. We need official red hats. We need official red hat merchandise of all kinds. And if you look at their website, they have an astonishing array now of red hat products, from jewelry, sneakers, all kinds of things. And it was another example of this kind of material aspect, kind of formal material aspect being added on by the people participating in it as a sort of, one person put it, as a kind of a badge of participation.
Yeah, and so those Red Hat Society women are share something in common with skateboarders?
Well, I make the point in the book that people commonly, they notice this in relation to youth subcultures, that there will be something like skateboarders or punk rock or something where this kind of de facto uniform emerges, and things that are just objects suddenly take on significance because of their association with, like, the safety pin in the punk subculture, or certain kinds of shoes among skateboarders, that they kind of symbolize membership in a group. We recognize it in subcultures, youth subcultures, pretty easily, but I was making the point that it isn't just a youth thing. It's a human thing that we like to be, you know, it's not always about just individualism. It's also about being part of something bigger than ourselves, and we like to find material ways to confirm that.
Yeah. So are we today still enamored by logos or consumer labels of some sort?
Well, you'll get different answers from people, and we have a tendency to, and I'm sure someone will call in and say, I can't stand logos. And branding isn't just about wearing a T-shirt with a logo on it. Branding is, like I said, it's that idea to thing concept. But it can manifest that way in the form of a logo. I talk in the book about this brand, Marc Ecko, sort of a hip-hop mm-hmm. associated brand. And, you know, his logo was this rhino that had nothing to do with hip-hop. It was inspired by something in his father's den. And, you know, you can put something like that on a T-shirt, and it doesn't really mean anything until people start wearing it and who's wearing it and what it kind of means in the marketplace. And it's that dialogue again where the real meaning of it comes from a kind of de facto collaboration between the creator and the consumer.
Yeah, and speaking of hip-hop, talk about the boots. Is it Timberland boots?
Timberland boots. Yeah. Really interesting case of this kind of consumer-created meaning for something, and similar in some ways to PBR, except that in this case, Timberland had a very clear idea of itself in the 90s. It was a kind of New England, blue-collar, working, functional brand, nothing to do with fashion or style. And it was just kind of gradually adopted by kind of hip-hop-type consumers, first in New York and then elsewhere, who weren't working on factory floors. Mm-hmm. They had their own... It just became sort of converted into a style object. It was just kind of because of who was wearing it and the context they were wearing it in, it just became kind of a part of the uniform of hip-hop, and then part of that was kind of echoed by kids in the suburbs who were taking their cues from hip-hop stars. And at first, the company, they just didn't know what to do with this, and they were just like, we're not going to sell to this market and because we don't understand, and we're worried that this is just a fad, and we don't know how to do fashion anyway. Well, eventually they came around to seeing that they were not in the position to completely make that decision themselves,
mm-hmm.
and that they were going to have to go along with what their consumers wanted, and started manufacturing, you know, pink versions of the boot and mm-hmm. speaking directly to that fashionable aspect of the brand.
Our guest, Rob Walker, the subject, Why We Buy What We Buy. and what it says about ourselves. His new book, Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Why do you buy what you buy? Did you buy an iPod? Do you drink Red Bull by any chance? Are you a member of the Red Hat Society? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Maybe you have some other examples you'd like to run by us. Our first caller is John in Madison. Hi, John. You're on the air.
Hi. Say, I think you're off base on the whole iPod thing. I had an MP3 player before I had an iPod, and I switched to the iPod because it had iTunes and because it's so convenient. You can take all your music, get rid of your CDs, get rid of your LPs, get rid of your tapes. All you have is this little device around, and the iTunes program that runs on the computer is way better than any other software like it on the market. So, and with my other MP3 player, I always struggled. I had a difficult time getting it to work and keeping the software up to date, and iPods just plain work. iTunes and iPods just work right out of the box, and they always work. And so I think that's why consumers go to it, because you plug it in and it goes.
Well, I certainly don't mean to suggest that there, again, I mean, mm-hmm. part of my point is that there is no single, in my view, there is no single one answer to the, when something reaches the level of popularity of the iPod, clearly answers are going to differ from consumer to consumer. And your case may be that. For others, I'm confident that for many people it was their first MP3 player and that they did not test anything else on the market. And it's a common myth that the iPod was the first player to have that hard drive that could hold that many songs. There was a prior product called the Creative Zen that was not well marketed. And Apple put a tremendous amount of marketing effort behind getting the iPod known both through traditional and non-traditional means. And, you know, as I say, the reasons I think vary. And I congratulate you on your purchase.
Yeah, thanks for calling, John. And then, as you say, it one answer doesn't fit all. I have a 21-year-old nephew who doesn't like the fact that, if I get this straight, he didn't like the iPod and the you have to get iTunes to load music onto iPods. He thought that was all, you know, whatever, corporate control of what he did. Yes?
For sure. And, you know, I just want to say that one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that it's very easy for us to recognize consumer behavior that we, you know, might question in other people, and very hard for us to second-guess ourselves. And there's nothing wrong with, any particular purchase. My goal is really to sort of say, to peel back the curtain both on how the commercial persuasion industry works and also how our minds sometimes work, and that there may be times when we sort of take these brand shortcuts and then tell ourselves after the fact that we'll, you know, I'm a rational person, so therefore I must have made the right rational decision. Sometimes clearly that's true. I don't know if it's helpful to just sort of think of ourselves as being brand-proof and above it all, and that there's much to be learned by maybe questioning our own motives sometimes.
Yeah. Nelson in Cedarburg is with us. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm disgusted by all of this. I think that people who want to define themselves by what they own they're a waste of skin. And people who are like that are just ripe for being turned into good little robots by whatever regime happens to be in power. And I've also been more and more dismayed since the 1980s by government trying to go with the business model, and that when we look at agency reports and stuff, they're trying to, you know, establish branding. They refer to taxpayers as customers. I just think that the commercial world is everywhere, and this phenomenon of trying to get people to define themselves in terms of products is scary and disgusting.
Well, Rob Walker?
Well, I hope that you understand that I'm not,
no, you're not
advocating
this
process. I'm describing a process that's I agree that this is exactly why I don't find the attitude that I encounter so often that we're that on an individual level this or that person is kind of above it all. You know, this is the world that we live in, and it's not helpful to approach the world that we live in, driven by the profit motive and these other things, coming from a place of supreme self-confidence and being above it all. I mean, this stuff is everywhere, and I do hope that the book, in a lot of ways, almost empowers people to be able to think twice about defining yourself in this way, and the ways in which you might be doing it without even thinking about it, and the ways in which, if this is a dialogue, and it is, between what we buy and who we are, that we can run that dialogue in the sense of deciding, well, what is really important to us? There are consumer issues that are quite important to us around, say, you know, the one that gets talked about a lot is the environment right now, about the ecological impact of some of our consumer behavior.
Mm-hmm.
None of us wants to be kind of complicit in causing problems in the world. So therefore, we have to really be thoughtful about what purchase decisions we're making and why we're making them. And the more you learn about how it works, I think, the smarter you'll be able to be in making decisions about the things that truly matter to you. And clearly something like being an individual isn't something that depends on what you purchase. You're already an individual, so maybe that's not the thing that should be on your mind when you're making shopping decisions, and you should be thinking about what are the things that are really important that I can really have an impact on
well, a lot of people,
by what I choose to buy and by what I choose not to buy, which is just as important.
Yeah, and a lot of people do want to buy products, for example, that are friendly to the environment, as you mentioned, and you do bring up the example of Method in the mm-hmm. in the book. Now, was Method marketing its products?
The interesting thing about Method is that when they first came onto the scene, they, which was not that long ago, it's actually had a fairly rapid rise. It's cleaning products, household products, and they were making them, or they are making them, with sort of earth-friendly materials and not using some of the synthetics and so on. But interestingly, they chose not to make that the centerpiece of their sort of sales pitch to the consumer. What they really made the centerpiece of their sales pitch was design. The bottles are beautiful. They mm-hmm. hired a major industrial designer to do one of their packaging executions, and it won all kinds of design awards and got them a lot of attention. And they even told me that some of their early consumers would tell them, well, I didn't really think this stuff would work, mm-hmm. but the package was so beautiful, I thought I'd give it a shot. And I guess they decided that it did work, and it had this other element to it of being relatively earth-friendly, which does seem to check out with the people that I spoke to who are knowledgeable of these matters.
Yeah. Is the green marketing a big part of why we buy what we buy?
Well, we're in a really interesting moment about that right now, mm-hmm. and your caller was talking about how, you know, there's this onslaught of marketing coming at us from all directions. Clearly, companies are aware that there is more consumer concern out there, and one of the things that makes the marketplace already so confusing is just this overload of symbols and messages coming at us from all directions. Now what's being added to that messaging is a lot of sometimes rather vague suggestions of, well, this is a green product or this is a natural product. And it's much easier to kind of change the messaging around a product than it is to change the product. So we've seen, I think we're at a sort of inflection point with this where I'm a little concerned almost that there's so much of this messaging that it's just going to confuse people and they're going to sort of throw up their hands and say, I don't get what is real and what isn't. And my main message to business in all of this would be to spend maybe a little bit less time worrying about emphasizing the one good thing, the best thing about your product, and maybe trying to find ways to change the worst thing about your product instead. It might be more productive.
We're talking about what we buy and why we buy it with Rob Walker, who is author of the book Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. Rob also writes the Consumed column for the New York Times Magazine. 1-800-642-1234. We welcome your questions for Rob Walker. Is there anything that you buy that you want to share with us and maybe why you have made that decision? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Coming up after 9 o'clock, Kathleen Dunn is with you. Kathleen and her guest will talk politics from around the state, the nation, and the world. She welcomes in Mike Goucher for All About Politics coming up after 9 o'clock. We're talking with Rob Walker, author of Buying In, welcoming your thoughts and questions for him about why we consume what we consume, why we buy what we buy, like why we buy Macs instead of PCs.
Hello, I'm a Mac.
And I'm a PC!
Woo! What's with the pep rally?
Well, come you're on. Selling in record numbers, more popular than ever with students, but what are we going to do?
Fight!
You know, you have that built-in EyeSight camera and that super stable operating system. You run Microsoft Office so well, maybe that's why you're the number one notebook on college campuses.
Mac's number one!
What?
Mac's number one!
No, no, you're supposed to be cheering for me.
All right, Rob Walker, does that help Max?
Interesting thing about that campaign is how hotly debated it is among people who really are, you'll find online actual arguments about what Mac people are like and whether they're a bunch of jerks or whether, I mean, people will just take the whole thing at face value and they'll say Mac people are snobs and they're suckers because they are paying extra and their stuff isn't any better. And, of course, the Mac people will contend that the PC people are a bunch of mindless conformists. So it's one of the more, and, you know, when you think about what we're talking about, computers, it's really quite hard to imagine that your computer choice is an actual manifestation of such intense emotions.
Yeah. Well, you know, we've been talking about these, I guess, new trends in marketing and the like. But we still see, you know, a bunch of these commercials on television. Why do we still see so many TV commercials on, you know, regular television if people aren't really paying attention to that?
Well, the responses to the TiVo DVR world rapidly outpaced the reality of it, in the sense that within a year or two of the announcement of this ad-zapping technology, the advertising business was well on the way to reinventing itself and moving very aggressively. I think even now, only maybe a quarter of U.S. homes have a DVR, so they're not going to stop running 30-second commercials when the vast majority of television users cannot fast-forward through them. And to me, I'm often asked, how will the 30-second commercial die? I almost think that it's just an irrelevant question. By the time it dies, if it does, it will just not matter anymore because all of these other forms of marketing, word-of-mouth marketing and guerrilla marketing and so on and so forth, will have become so pervasive that they just won't need it anymore, if it ever happens.
Back to the phones. Ruth in Chippewa County is with us now. Hi.
Morning. I guess I was just noticing the fact that being a nonconformist, they seem to start conforming. And an example of this would be tattoos. It used to be people didn't have tattoos. They were just not considered normal. The nonconformists always, they had them. And now everybody has them. Grandmas have them. It's unbelievable. is that an example of what you're talking about?
Yeah, it's certainly something where it just becomes more and more acceptable, and it becomes sort of, I mean, you've got to figure that tattoo removal is going to be one of the great growth industries of the of the next decade. And yeah, there's a certain kind of person that you look at, and you're almost like, well, where is it? Where's the tattoo? It did. It completely became a converted symbol from kind of almost a real outlaw-ish thing to just kind of trendy.
Well, I have a girlfriend who is a grandma and wanted me to get a tattoo with her, and I'm happy to say that I declined.
It's a serious decision.
Yeah, no.
Good to think twice about that one.
Yeah. Shelley in Stratford, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, I'm just kind of backing up a little bit, talking about products that you buy because of earth-friendly. And I used to ridicule my friends because they spent so much money at salons, at Aveda salons. And then I ended up going and found out that Aveda does so much for the environment, and their employees actually turn in their caps and they use recycled bottles. And they have a company where it's mostly windows and glass ceilings to use instead of energy. So now I am a purchaser of Aveda just because of that.
Well, Shelley, we're glad you got that in. I guess you just buy it. You're not a seller of it. I thought you were plugging your product. But
I'm just a consumer.
I get it. All right, yeah. So that all plays into why we buy stuff, right, Rob Walker?
And for sure, what's good about that is that it isn't just about the company's messaging. It's about the company's actual business model. And it's nice to reward those kind of things, but at the same time, you have to be careful about it. Sometimes it's easy to sort of think, well, I'm doing my good deed as an eco-friendly consumer over here. Now let me get back in my SUV and drive away or whatever.
Well, we can't be perfect.
You can't be perfect, but it's always good to not only be feeling good about the stuff you're doing right, but maybe giving thought to looking at what you choose not to buy as well.
How about where we buy stuff? A lot of folks say, I'm not going to go buy anything at Walmart.
Yeah, well, and that's certainly a lot of people also decide to buy everything at Walmart, but truthfully, one of the great forms of consumer power, much more powerful in my view than, you'll hear a lot about, well, I complained on a blog and I got a free product or whatever. It's much, the ultimate mechanism of consumer power is what we choose not to buy, where we choose not to shop. And you've seen this in the past with some of the great consumer movements of days gone by that led to product labeling and improved safety and so on that were inspired by essentially boycott threats and more collective-based action. Mm-hmm. And that's something that I hope we see more of in the future.
Anne in Verona. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to steal your thunder, Anne.
Hi. I'm just calling because I purchase things more on what I don't want to buy than what I do want to buy, and that is things that are boycotted, such as Walmart. And I'm still boycotting Purdue Chicken because of their unfair labor practices, and Del Monte. The other one is Kraft. So that's what dictates my purchases.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. There's a really interesting movement going on that I talk about in the book. It's the sort of handmade DIY crafty movement. It's a lot of young people who are making things, making clothes, making jewelry and making just object pottery and selling them on a really cottage industry kind of level, often online. It's really been revitalized by the internet, and there is an ideology in the background of it that's similar to all this, where it's positioned as a kind of rejection of more mainstream mass stuff, where it's really hard to figure out, well, who made this and under what conditions and using what materials, and this is more of a one-to-one thing. It's a very interesting model. And it is drawing in not just people like caller here who are really consciously thinking about it at the beginning of the process, which people like, not everyone's doing that, but it's bringing in people who maybe come to it for other reasons. They just say, like, well, that's a beautiful sweater, but why is it so much more expensive than the one I could get at Walmart? And because they're dealing with a seller one-to-one, that seller can say, well, I made this myself, I used these materials, you don't know where that other one came from, And it kind of draws people into this new way of thinking about material culture. It's pretty interesting.
Our guest, Rob Walker, his book, Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. By any chance, did you ever pick up one of those Lance Armstrong Livestrong bracelets? 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Why did you do that? Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. We have an open line for you if you want to talk about why we buy, what we buy, and what it says about us, and what prompts us these days to make that consumer purchase. Rob Walker writes about this in the book, Buying In. Talk a little bit about that, the Livestrong bracelet craze, Rob Walker. How did that become so successful?
It's an amazing story. It was, as you recall, I'm sure, it was Lance Armstrong wore the original one on the Tour de France, and his rest of his team and his mechanics and everybody was wearing them, and then other riders started wearing them. And it was really, I mean, it was just a round hunk of plastic. It wasn't going to win any design awards anytime soon. But celebrities started picking up on it. I remember John Kerry wore one mm-hmm. when he was accepting the nomination for president. And soon they were just everywhere. In fact, the demand for them was so intense that they really didn't have enough. And people were selling theirs on eBay. It was sort of out of control. A portion of the proceeds went, or I think 70% of the proceeds, it cost a dollar, went to the Lance Armstrong Foundation. And this was another case where there wasn't just one answer, much like the iPod, although in the case of the iPod, there's sort of this overflow of functionality. Armstrong bracelet really didn't have much functionality, right. But it was drawing people in. For some, it was a very personal thing. For some, because they would wear it in support of an individual. In some cases, it was more just the broader idea of supporting a good cause. In some, I'm sure it was just to kind of participate in the trend situation. And so, for all these reasons, it went from nowhere to being. Just perfectly acceptable and recognizable part of everyday life.
Plus, they only cost a buck, just like the PBRs.
Yeah, I think that always helps.
No. Anyway, I was at a summer festival, I don't know, a few summers ago, and some goofy-looking small vehicle with Red Bull logos all over it was driving around passing out free Red Bull. And I had one and hated it. Red Bull is really, they're experts at this marketing, aren't they?
Yeah, when I started following Red Bull, it was when they were just coming into the American market and they were introducing themselves. And they weren't doing, usually when a product comes along and they make a big announcement and say, here we are, here's what we're about, here's why you should buy it, and here's who it's for. And with Red Bull, they never really did that. Instead of primetime television commercials, they were doing these little small events or the kind of thing that you saw where they were just handing out samples outside an office. And interestingly, they were almost inconsistent in where they were doing this. For some, it was kind of in an athletic context, mm-hmm. and sometimes it was at nightclubs, sometimes it was around college campuses. And each little group sort of adopted it as their own, and it spread not just through one path, but through multiple paths, which I think turned out to be a shrewd approach in this kind of media fractured era that we were heading into. And now you have it as a product that it's just really unusual. It's hard to think of another beverage that gets sold in gyms and nightclubs. Mm-hmm. Just very rare.
And now they have a diet version, too.
Yes, they have a diet version as well, and big stacks of it at Kroger.
And it's not just Red Bull, though, too. This has just really hit off a craze. I mean, there's you know, Rockstar and Monster, and yeah. I mean, just shelves and shelves and shelves of this kind
of
stuff.
Yeah, and one of the funny things is that Red Bull, to the extent they made a pitch, it said on the can, with taurine, which, you know, no one knew what that was and why it was supposed to be significant. Yeah. And as far as anybody can tell, it really doesn't have any particular effect. But it all of these followers that came in afterwards, they all have taurine because the consumer basically expects it now.
Was it Red Bull that held the kites boarding race to Cuba?
Yeah, I went down to Florida to see one of their mini stunts in action, and it was fascinating because it was They were, yeah, sending a group of kiteboarders. We're going to go the full 90 miles from Key West to Varadero, Cuba on these little wind-blown contraptions. And the way that they were doing it, it wasn't like a big publicity stunt where they'd invited all the media. I was kind of the only real reporter there. It was designed just to be, this is this outrageous stunt, and these people who are participants in the extreme sports scene will talk about this, and they'll talk about the fact that Red Bull did this outrageous, crazy stunt, and it will spread in that little world. But the key was that they were doing that as well as other completely unrelated music-related things that would spread in that world, and then these office worker sampling like you saw. And it wasn't everyone following, because for some people, Red Bull does not have that connotation of being an extreme sports thing. It has some totally other connotation.
Yeah, so I'm usually out of it when it comes to the latest trends and such. Is there something right now that's, flying off store shelves because everybody's got to have it, or because of this marketing, or something that you can share with us?
One of the more recent ones, I guess this isn't brand new, but I wrote about it not too long ago in the column, and I continue to be fascinated by it because it continues to hold on, is these Crocs shoes.
Oh, yeah, those things are ugly, aren't they?
And, well, this is the thing, is that I theorize that if you ask a Crocs wearer what it's about, they'll always say it's about, oh, it's just about comfort. And yet they'll have 10 different pairs and 10 different colors and all this. And I think that they kind of like the idea that they know that it ticks some people off when they wear these things around. And there's a little bit of a sort of a maverick image, I think, that somehow has come along with these odd-looking
shoes. Did that Food Network Mario Batali, did he start that whole thing?
I don't think he started it, but he was certainly one of the popularizers of it. It was it helped a lot the reputation for comfort that these, and also he was he's sort of a character himself. So that idea that I'm so unconcerned with the aesthetics of these shoes that I'll wear them even though it's sort of strange looking, and that's almost being so unconcerned with aesthetics that what you really like is the aesthetics.
Yeah, you know, we only have 30 seconds left. The moral of your story is maybe you want to think before you buy?
The moral of the story is the more you know about how these processes work, both the professional side and the individual side, your own side of the process, I think the smarter and the more satisfying your decisions will ultimately be.
We thank you very much for your time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Rob Walker, author of Buying In, The Secret Dialogue Between What We Buy and Who We Are. You may also read his column, Consumed, in the New York Times Magazine. Thanks to Carmen Jackson, Cynthia Schuster, and Rob Ferret for producing this hour. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.